wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for your company once again on truthtoyou.org. That's truth2u.org. Joining me is the author of the website Silver Trumpets. The website address is bneimikra.wordpress.com. He also manages the Facebook group American Karaite Judaism. Welcome back to the program, Isaac Keit.
Always a pleasure, Jonah.
Wonderful to have you again, my friend. Now, last time we spoke, I did read a comment from Derek, and he asked a question in that comment. We thought we would address it this time. And just to let everybody, remind everyone what that question was, Derek Jabowski from Canada. G'day, mate. In fact, I happen to know he's in Israel at the moment. Hope he's having a great time. I'm sure he is. In the next conversation with Isaac, he wrote, could you ask his opinion on how and why having a Jewish mother became the rule to be recognized as a Jew in Orthodox Judaism? Now, here we are in the debate, the ever ongoing debate, patrilineal descent versus matrilineal. And it ties quite nicely into an article that you have just penned and put on your website, simply entitled, Who is a Jew? So how shall we begin? Shall we begin with some defining of terms? Can you tell us what is this particular article about?
Okay, well, the article is about the big question. This is something that is very, I don't want to say, defining of Judaism, how fractious we are and the fact that we can't agree that the sky is blue. The question of who is a Jew? If you ask 100 Jews, you're going to get 300 opinions. Mm-hmm. So it's... No one has an easy answer to it. I'm going to read a quote from the article from Herman Wouk, who's an Orthodox Jew in America and mm-hmm. has written extensively on topics like this. And in his book, This Is My God, which was published back in 1959, he said on page 16, various disputants all hold that Jews are a race or a nation or a religion or a people or a sect or a state of mind in non-Jews. Agreement on the topic does not occur, except among anti-Semites who know that Jews are international fiends. Right. Which is just, to make an interesting point. If you ask who's a Jew to any group of Jews, you're going to get a very politically charged answer, and it's going to be several different aspects. Who carries this status and why and how do they earn it and this kind of thing. And mostly I'm going to talk today about Jews by birth, or what we like to say in Judaism, the accident of your birth, quite accurately. Versus Jew by choice, which is another topic for another time and mm-hmm. a whole nother can of worms. So in terms of who is a Jew, we have two main traditions on the subject, and those are, as we've discussed, matrilineal and patrilineal. In the Talmud, in Mishnah, there's the third order of Mishnah, Nashim, which is wives or women. There's Tractate Kiddushin, and in that, the sages unanimously agree that Judaism is established matrilineally. That is, a Jew is a Jew whose mother was a Jew. So if my mother was a Jew, I'm a Jew. If my mother was not a Jew, I'm not a Jew, irrespective of who my father is or whether he was a Jew. This is an interesting ruling, and it comes at a very interesting time. We have a lot of genetic evidence at the time that mitochondrial DNA, which is passed down from the mother to mm-hmm. their children, shows that there were a lot of Jews marrying Mediterranean and Italian women at the time. And so there's been rumors for a long time that this judgment was arrived at because Jews were marrying out. There's also the question, did these women convert? You know, how did that all work? We don't know for sure. But one interesting point that's made about matrilineal descent in that time also is that paternity could not be easily determined until fairly recently. Even now, it can be problematic. But the fact is, you can't, in the ancient world, you couldn't definitely be certain who the father was. Mm-hmm. But you would always know who the mother was. And so, for simplicity's sake, perhaps, to abate the crisis of the moment, to deal with issues that were going on in their time, the Mishnaic sages, and perhaps rightly so, decided that Jewish descent would be matrilineal. So that was the decision they made. That said, from a textual point of view, that is actually the weaker of the two arguments. If you look at the scriptures, the patrilineal side is a much stronger argument. And therefore, the Karaite tradition, they arrived at a very different conclusion. By reading the scriptures, the Karaite Hachamim determined that patrilineal descent was the strongest argument mm-hmm. in the text, and they decided to go with that. So in Karaite Judaism, you're a Jew if your father was a Jew,
right,
irrespective of who your mother was. And this creates that interesting opposite, you know. So, you know, they say the mother, we say the father. So this creates the situation that we find ourselves in now. And then it gets more complicated than that, because this is Judaism we're talking about. And if we can possibly make things at all more complicated, we will. The status of Levite is always patrilineal, whether it's in rabbinical or Karaite tradition. Mm-hmm. A Levite is a Levite who is a man whose father was a Levite. The status of Kohen is similar. Your father must be a Kohen for you to be a Kohen, a direct descendant of Aharon, mm-hmm. the high priest, brother of Moshe. Again, in both traditions, those statuses pass down the father's line. So in my argument, basically, I talk about the scriptural arguments in the article between matrilineal and patrilineal. There are backing for both positions. Obviously, the stronger is for patrilineal. So let's talk about that a little bit and where that comes from in the Torah. You start into Bereshit, Genesis. Mm-hmm. We see the lineages that are given from there. We have Adam and Chava, and then it goes through male descendants thereafter. We don't even know who the females were in most cases. They aren't even mentioned all the way down to Lamech, right? And then we go from there down to Noah, and down through Noah's sons to all the way down to Abraham, mm-hmm. right? So we have our first of our patriarchs. And in Karaite tradition, the patriarchs are used as a model, examples for law and traditions, because their behavior informs us of how things should be done properly. Mm-hmm. And when we look at the patriarchs, we see that Abraham is the founder of this great nation, several great nations, actually. And from him to Yitzhak is passed this blessing. Rivka only shows up in the story when it comes time for Yitzhak to marry. And then she makes her way, even though she's already a member of the house of Betuel, she makes her way from Chaldea over to marry Yitzhak. Leah and Rachel, the same way. They enter the biblical narrative when Yaakov is looking to marry. And he marries both of them and their servants. And then he has 12 sons. And we know who all those 12 sons were. We have listed names of all of those. And we know them very well. Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Reuven. Each of these men was the founder of a tribe, with the exception of Yosef, whose name doesn't stay with the tribe. His tribe is mentioned by the names of his sons, Menashe and Ephraim. And it's important to note, Yosef married an Egyptian woman.
That's right.
Asenet. And so these two young men who founded half-tribes of Menashe and Ephraim, these men were sons of an Egyptian woman, but also sons of Yosef. Mm. So we have that. We have several other lineages, the lineage from Boaz and Ruth down to David, straight through the male line. And we have other biblical lineages and narratives that mention patrilineal descent. So patrilineal descent is pretty strong. There's a very strong case.
But it'd be fair to say, not only is it pretty strong, I mean, would it not be fair to say that it is the unbroken rule from the beginning to the end of the Tanakh?
That would be fair to say. Hmm. The patrilineal descent is, textually speaking, the way descent is determined.
I would cite Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 15, which says, "Yet it was to your fathers that the Lord was drawn in his love for them, so that he chose you, their lineal descendants, from among all peoples, as is now the case."
Yes, yes. And this is an important point when we say the various blessings. You know, we say, you know, the God of Abraham, of Yitzhak, of Yaakov, right? Mm. And there are traditions that repeat then after that of Sarah, Rivka, and Leah and Rachel. But we, you know, we mentioned the male names of the patriarchs, you know, not the female names. This is a fairly new tradition that has arisen. So when we think of our lineage, it is to our fathers, like you've said, as you pointed out, right? So we also have a couple of examples of matrilineal descent that are listed in the scriptures, right? We have the Israelite man who profaned Hashem, and mm-hmm. it's mentioned that he was the son of an Israelite woman named Shulamit, right? And that's one thing that is mentioned of him, that his mother was Israelite, and it says nothing of his father. This is in Vayikra 24:11.
Okay, so this is the penalty for blasphemy. This is what we have in verse 10. Now the son of an Israelite woman whose father was an Egyptian. So we know that much about his father.
Mm-hmm. He was not an Israelite. Hmm. Yes. So he was a son of an Israelite woman. He blasphemed the name of Hashem and cursed, right? And they took him to Moshe, who judged him for having done this. Mm-hmm. But it says he was the son of Shulamit, the daughter of Divri of the tribe mm-hmm. of Dan, right? So this is an example of matrilineal descent. We also have the story of Hiram.
Hang on a second. I'm going to interrupt you. Is this, when you say this is an example of matrilineal descent, do you mean to say that this is an example of a certain individual has an Egyptian father but an Israelite mother and therefore is an Israelite?
Yes.
So
he went out with the people.
You see that this is, you see that this man, okay, but let me ask you another question about that. This particular chap, does he inherit land?
This is an interesting question. He would within the tribe of Dan because his mother is the tribe of Dan. Unlike the daughters of Zelophehad, he doesn't have the difficulty of having to marry within his tribe because being a man, he doesn't have that that status issue. Although this woman ought to have married a man of Dan, or at least an Israelite. In any case, they came out of Egypt. People had already been married or established family relationships. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, he was the son of an Egyptian man. We don't know if the father came with or remained in Egypt. Presumably, he remained in Egypt. And this young man just happened, for whatever reason, to curse Hashem's name. He was judged as an Israelite.
Was he? I mean, let's focus in on this because this is an interesting case. It says, now the son of an Israelite woman whose father was an Egyptian went out among the children of Israel. Now, immediately there seems to be a distinction made. It says, went out into among the children of Israel, and this Israelite woman's son and a man of Israel fought each other in the camp. Again, a distinction, this Israelite woman's son and an actual man of Israel. And the Israelite woman's son blasphemed the name of the Lord and cursed. And so they brought him to Moses. His mother's name, as you said, the name is there, of the tribe of Dan. They put him in custody as to, you know, to find out what shall be done. As a result, he was, Moses said, you know, take him outside the camp. The congregation will stone him for blasphemy. It goes on then to talk about laws that pertain not only to Israelites, but also to foreigners who dwell with them.
That is true. But note that in the distinction, he went into the among the tribe. That's just a location where he went. And he fought with another man of Israel. Mm-hmm. He fought with this man is simply identified as this man was an Israelite. It's not as if this young man.
But you have to admit, though, Isaac, you've got to admit else. he's not identified as an Israeli.
Not in particular, but it does note that he has an Israelite mother. Mm. And he is then judged under Israelite law. Moshe does not make a separate law for him. Whether we're talking about the foreigner in our midst or whether we're talking about someone who is eligible to be an Israelite, the law is applied the same.
And that's what it says. It says here the stranger as well as him who was born in the land. And then it goes on to list a number of laws that apply to both. My point is that this particular chap is not identified specifically as an Israelite.
It's not clear.
If there is an unbroken rule of patrilineal descent, that would make this chap not an Israelite. Is that fair?
You can look at it both ways. But the question here, this does create some of that legal question, right?
Yeah.
Is this person an Israelite? And sometimes this person's referred to as a half-Israelite. Well, we have another example that's very similar in the case of Hiram. Hiram was a brass worker from Tira who was sent to work on the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And his mother was a Naphtali, the tribe of Naphtali, who had married a man of Tira, who was not an Israelite. And this young man was able to work on the temple and make the brass workings, the pillars, the basin, and the various other brass objects for the temple. So this is another example of potentially matrilineal descent.
He is not considered, though, it's fair to say, nor is he ever identified as an Israelite.
Again, yes, but it is another example of matrilineal descent being mentioned, right?
It's another example of a mixed marriage in which his mother was Jewish, an Israelite, of the tribe of Naphtali. but clearly not identified as an Israelite as a result.
In part, that is true.
And we have, I'll just read
but
from
we do you. Have, but oh. we do have, in these two particular cases, we do have mentions of a person whose father was not Israelite and whose mother was. And that's that's the only reference I make to them in the article. Just making the point that we do have some scriptural references to these people, whether we get into the specifics of their, are they specifically identified or what have
you. I love specifics.
What we do know. Specifics can be fun.
Because I love the specifics, let's just touch on this. Sure. So this is 1 Kings 7, chapter 13 and 14. Now King Solomon sent forth Huram from Tyre. He was the son of a widow from the tribe of Naphtali, and his father was a man of Tyre, a bronze worker. He was filled with wisdom and understanding and skill in working with all kinds of bronze. So he came to King Solomon and did his work, but clearly not identified as an Israelite. I'm just pointing out.
Yes, but he did work on the temple.
He did.
In that he was allowed to work on the temple is a clear identification of his connection to the people.
Sure.
Again, not specifically, you know, this person was an Israelite, and wouldn't that be nice to have that well written out? All right, so then we have the scribe and Sadducite priest, Ezra, has the people back. They've returned from the exile. Here he is. He's reading the Torah to the people. Mm. In one morning, he read the Torah to the people, and they're reconsecrating the temple. And at a certain point there, the men were forced to cast off their foreign wives. Mm-hmm. This is a very big question. Why did they have to cast off their wives? Some rabbinical commentators have argued that that very act established matrilineal descent. And some will make the argument, not all, that it was at that point that the change was made, right there at the end of the scriptures.
I've read that, but it's a bit of a Rubik's Cube when you get to Ezra and you read chapter 9, chapter 10, and then you have to go back and piece it all together and say, why were these wives sent away? In that study of trying to get all the colors on the right side of your Rubik's Cube, it will take you to, of course, Deuteronomy chapter 7, the early verses thereof, where it says, when the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess, and you cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, Hivites, the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you, then the Lord your God, when he delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them, nor shall you make marriages with them. And so there it is.
Mm-hmm. We have an example of not making marriages with foreigners. In this particular case, even if those foreigners convert or come to live as Israelites, they may not be accepted. Hmm. But we do have some cases like that. We also have, for example, that a member of Moab, of the nation of Moab, may not enter the assembly. Hmm. Which brings us to another interesting point here about the assembly. And what is interesting there, people always bring up, well, you know, what about Ruth? She was a Moabite and this kind of thing. In any case, there's no mention that she ever entered the congregation, which is back to that point. What is the congregation? The gathering at the temple is what we're talking about here. There are various rules on who may and may not enter this congregation. Mm-hmm. A Moabite may never be among them. No one who is of Moab may be among these in the congregation. When Ruth marries Boaz, first of all, she's made an oath to Naomi that she's going to be a member of this people, right? She's shown a dedication to the people.
She
comes and lives among us, so she becomes acquainted with Israelite customs. She becomes a servant of Boaz, and she works for him, which is a very interesting point because in the next topic of conversion, we get into a very interesting point about servitude as a pathway to citizenship. And we also have that she marries Boaz. Now, remember that in a tribal people, the woman, when she leaves her tribe, she marries into the tribe of the other person, which is one of the reasons why the daughters of Zelophehad could not marry outside of their tribe, because otherwise they would take their inheritance with them out of the tribe, because it would go to their husbands. All of the lands that they're tied to them, all of their inheritance goes to their husband's use, and that would mean outside of their tribe. Mm. So, you know, if they marry a man of Ephraim, then we've just deprived their tribe of
that land.
Whatever, of that land.
Which is rightfully belonging to, now if I remember correctly, Manasseh, I think, is the tribe of the daughters of Zelophehad.
And so that needs to stay with them. And that's where we get this. So now here we have, in this case of Ruth, she's a Moabite, she marries an Israelite, And now through her oath, through her dedication to our people, through her knowledge, her knowledge of our customs, and now her marriage to an Israelite, she is regarded as an Israelite and no longer a Moabite. Now, I've heard people make the argument, you know, the fields of Moab, and there were some Israelites who had gone out there before, and maybe Ruth was a member of Moab. It was not actually a Moabite, but she was actually an Israelite that was descended there. You know, this idea that there were degenerate Israelites living there who could be called Moabites, this goes against what is
written.
It's not
in the text. It's not in the text.
Right there in Ruth chapter 1, verse 2, it says very clear, Ruth was a daughter of Moab. And that's it. And then either so if she was not a Moabite, then the author is lying to us, and none of this is worth reading in the first place. Or what we read is what we know, and we take it as truth, as revelation, in the form of a book in the Ketuvim, or rather part of the narrative that is important to our people. And she was a Moabite, and you know, her husband Boaz, they begat children down a male lineage to David, which is why that story is important.
Right.
Which is why we know about it. But this is the point. Entering the congregation, the people who are blessed at the temple, making the offerings, this is something that can only be done by an Israelite. You must be first an Israelite, and then second, you must meet all these other criteria. And even then, you know, a Moabite may not enter that congregation, you know, very clearly.
Let me go back to just because I did read out Deuteronomy chapter 7, and it talks about the seven nations which you must not enter into contract with, including marriage. Now, when we get to Deuteronomy chapter 20, because you did mention that there are nations with which we can marry, it says in verse 15, now these are in regards to the cities, that are far from those seven nations, outside of the land. Thus you shall do to all the cities which are very far from you, which are not of the cities of these seven nations, it says. But of the cities of the nations that the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance, let nothing that breathes remain alive. You shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite, the Ammonite, the Canaanite, and so on and so forth, lest they teach you to do according to all their abominations, which they have done to their gods, and you sin against the Lord your God. And that may go towards what we're going to talk about. I'm sure you're going to talk about when we get to Ezra again, chapter 10. But it goes a little further in chapter 21 when it talks about the female captives of those cities that are far away, not of the seven nations that are immediately in the vicinity, but of those cities that are far outside of the perimeter. It says, you know, when you go and make war against them, the Lord your God delivers them into your hand, and you take them captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and you desire her and would take her for your wife. Clearly she is not Jewish. Clearly she's not an Israelite. But yes. But they may desire to take her. Then it says, well, this is the Lord. This is what you will observe before you do that. And it says, you know, you shall bring her home to your house, you know, shave your head, trim the nails, and she shall put off the clothes of her captivity, remain in the house and mourn for her father and her mother one full month. After that, you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. And it shall be, and it goes on.
Okay, so first of all, you found this woman you want to marry. She's from a foreign people. She's been conquered. She mourns her parents. We know the mourning period is 30 days. That's part of our tradition. She shaves her head. She cleans herself. You know, she's cleansed. She lets go of all of that. She shaves her head. And for 30 days, she mourns, during which time she learns to be one of us, and she chooses to become one of us. And that is a very different process, say, from, you know, a ger living among us.
I got to interrupt you there because it doesn't actually say that she chooses. She doesn't really, we don't have specifically in the text that she chooses anything. She is a woman of captivity.
Yes.
And what we have in black and white is that if you desire her, you cannot just take her. She has rights, and there is this... this process. Now, to the point of the conversation that we're having, the offspring that they have clearly are regarded as Israelites.
Yes, and this is, again, you have power over her. Chooses is probably the wrong word, but let's just put it this way. You have power over her. You can make her observe the traditions, and you can make sure that the children are raised as Israelites. First of all, they'll be surrounded by Israelites because they're going to live in an Israelite community.
Yeah.
Exactly. They're immersed. And so the mourning of her parents and the letting go of her idols, this is very important that none of that stuff continues. This is very, very important thing about whether it applies, whether conversion, marriage, however we're going to do things. We cannot bring these wicked practices into our nation. Right. And this is where we get to Ezra.
That's right.
Okay, so he's got the men of the congregation in front of him. And we have, at that point, a few questions that we might ask ourselves. So why do these women have to be cast off? Well, first of all, this is not just some act of cruelty. Oh, you've married, you know, women who are not ethnically Israelite, and we're going to cast you off.
Now, let me just go there, because there's a key verse in chapter 10, and that is verse 3, because it says, "Now, therefore, let us make a covenant with our God to put away these wives and those who have been born to them, according to the advice of my master and of those who tremble at the commandment of our God." And this is key, "let it be done according to the law." And so what then is suggested is that, or really what is being said, is that we have to find a precedent in the Torah to put these women away. Now, again, I would refer back to both Deuteronomy chapter 7. We have the seven nations that we're not allowed to enter into contract with. We cannot marry them. But the interesting thing about the list that is given in chapter 9, verse 1, in fact, I'll read it. "The people of Israel and the priests of the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the lands with respect to the abominations of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites." Now, Moabites and Egyptians are not mentioned among the seven. So where is this found within the Torah? Deuteronomy 23, verse 3, "An Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. None of his descendants shall enter the assembly of the Lord forever."
Yes. And so we have very specific instances that for a number of generations, which they clearly believed they were still that these generations were still going forward, that people had taken wives. Now, if they have taken Moabite wives or what have you, who are still Moabite, that is, they had not become Israelite, then they must cast them off. And within those generations, whether they convert or not, they have to be cast off anyway. This is what it says. So the point here is, you know, we're looking at these men have these wives who are from these other nations where Hashem said, don't do this. And so they're fulfilling the commandment. And that makes it very clear that they're fulfilling a commandment not to be married to these people, the commandment that is written and clearly stated. And so our traditions today and the laws that we have today that we're trying to follow are based on what is written, based on the traditions that prevailed 2,000 years ago, and based on those laws that have been given by our various hachamim or rabbis since then, depending on which tradition you adhere to. There is some flexibility given in the scripture on certain details. When you read the scripture, as you can tell, the textual argument for patrilineal descent is solid.
Solid from the beginning of the Tanakh to the end. Now, you mentioned Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 9. Just a little bit further in verse 15 of the same chapter, it says, "You may indeed set a king over you whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as a king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother." The interesting thing about this is that, you know, we go a little bit further along in the Tanakh. We get to 2 Samuel chapter 3, verse 3, and we find out that Absalom, the third son, I believe, of David, great head of hair, his mother was not Jewish. Son of Maachah, daughter of King Talmai of Geshur. He never became king, to be fair. Yes. He would have liked to have become king,
and he was a usurper. Actually,
so, he was indeed, yes. and it could have been. Now, when we get to 1 Kings chapter 14, verse 21, Solomon's son Rehoboam. Rehoboam's mother is mentioned in 14:21 as Naamah, the Ammonitess. Now, she's not an Israelite. But Rehoboam was most certainly king, and no one would dare suggest that he was not an Israelite. Yes. We also mentioned, you brought up the case of the example of the daughters of Zelophehad, who were of Manasseh. Now, we read in 1 Chronicles 7, chapter 14 to 15, that the descendants of Manasseh, Azriel, was his descendant through his Aramean concubine. She gave birth to Machir, the father of Gilad. Machir took a wife from among the Huppites and the Shupites. His sister's name was Ma'cha. Another descendant was named Zelophehad. So, but we see here that, and as you mentioned already, of course, Ephraim and Manasseh, their mother was an Egyptian. And we see here and also that Azrael, as the descendant of Manasseh, through his Aramean concubine, she gave birth to Machir. And so we see that line from a patrilineal perspective as well. Exactly. And again, no one would suggest that they're not Israelites.
That's right.
So these are just a couple.
We have solid patrilineal examples. Descent. Definitely, a Karaite tradition is very solid. There, we have no doubt.
But when it comes to authority, 2,000 years ago, or even a little less, and we talk about rabbinic authority, the question that Derek was asking is at what point did it change, and on what authority? How did it change? And to be fair, I don't think we have any specific documentation, do we?
We do, and as I mentioned in Nashim Kedushin, we have a rabbinical judgment.
We have a rabbinical judgment. That's
true. In fact, they don't even debate it. It's unanimous.
That's unanimous. But this is my point. There's no reason given for that particular judgment, and we don't know what instigated. We can only speculate that perhaps it was because of, as you mentioned, not necessarily sure who the father is, but we always know who the child popped out of.
Exactly.
you have that. And so there is the argument that, because perhaps Roman rape was rampant, that this rule was observed, or in fact because Roman law itself was matrilineal, that perhaps that just filtered through into Jewish society. Your thoughts?
That is an interesting point there, and I just want to make a note while we're talking about that. We have a big problem in Israel right now. Because under Russian law, a person is identified by their ethnicity according to their father. And this has always been this way, and it was the same way with the Soviet Union. So we have a number of people who are ethnically Jewish according to Russian law or Soviet law because their father was a Jew. Mm-hmm. But because their mother was not Jewish, they're allowed to immigrate to Israel. The law of return is very generous.
As Israeli citizens, but not identified as Jews.
But not Jewish because of that. Whereas, of course, in Karaite Judaism, we take them right in. Welcome. Come in.
Well, this is it. Now, by the way, speaking of which, because there are many such examples, for example, Ethiopian Jews.
That's right, are also patrilineal, and that is another interesting point to be made. But the point I was making back, that earlier one, because of Russian politics then, we have this issue in Israel today of, are these people Jews? Well, if Romans are matrilineal, this would have created a political problem for Jews at the time. How are we going to discern Judaism because we're going against Roman law, right? Mm-hmm. And this becomes a little bit of a challenge in that regard. So this is one of those areas where Jews have to contend with the legal systems of other people, and they may have simply done it for the convenience of it. Mm-hmm. And we have the flexibility to make judgments like that for that reason, even though I don't agree with that judgment. The scripture is pretty clear on what it says. I'd like to take the moment to take this all a step further I want to take the opportunity to inject my own opinion, because there is something that we have happened in Judaism that I am that I find very objectionable. And so I do not concur with any identification of Jewishness or status as a Jew that does not involve the practice of Judaism. That's my mic drop. If you are a Jew, that means you are, one, eligible to be a Jew, either by birth or by conversion, and two, a person who practices Judaism, right?
Now, this is very clear, and you outline this in detail in your article. I will put a link under this post, your latest article, Who is a Jew? And you make this very clear. But that has to then be coupled with the definition of, and correct me if I'm wrong, but your definition of a Jew is not only one who descends from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but physically descends from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but also practices the faith thereof.
That's right. You have to be both. And one of the reasons I find this objectionable is this question of people who call themselves Jews, but do not practice Judaism, are not involved in any Jewish community, and really aren't connected at all to any kind of Jewish practice, Jewish people, or that kind of thing. And one of those challenges is that a large number of Jews, people eligible to be Jews, let's just say, have been involved in the leftist movements throughout history. And unfortunately, Karl Marx himself was descended from Jews. I won't apply that title to so wicked a man, but I just say that he was ethnically descended from people who were Jewish. So when you look at this, a lot of these people are, in terms of their ideology, if you actually question their beliefs, they're socialists or they're leftists or they're one form or another of atheist. They're not Jews, but they call themselves Jews because they certainly don't want to be white. They have to be involved in their identity politics of their ideology. And so when people come to me every now and then in my political circles and what have you and say, why are Jews so left wing? And the answer is we're not. If you take that half of people, and Ben Shapiro and a number of other people argue very strongly that about half the people who self-identify as Jews in America, for example, are actually secular leftists. If you take those people out and poll people who are actually practicing Judaism, their political beliefs are more balanced. They're more like the majority of Americans as a voting population. And we're biased there by this idea of Judaism as an ethnic identity. But it is very clear, again, going back to the quotes from Herman Wouk, we're more than just an ethnic identity. Sure. We are clearly also a belief system. And so those two elements must be there. You must have some ethnic identity or some authority, that is, either you are descended from Jews or you are authorized as a convert by Jewish national authorities, the nation of Israel, not necessarily the state of Israel. You are recognized by one religious movement, Jewish religious movement, as a Jew by conversion or by birth, and you are practicing Judaism. And I'm very strong in that belief, so much so that I actually believe that when secular Jews return to Judaism, if they are not raised as Jews, you know, if you're raised within the tradition and you continue to practice the tradition, good for you. But there are a number of people like myself who are Baal Teshuvah. That means master of the return. We are raised secular, and then we decide that we want to practice Judaism. We may be eligible by birth, but we're not really Jews. We're not in the tradition. We haven't practiced. We don't know. I knew absolutely nothing. I may have known less than others who go come to us as converts, and they say, "Hey, look, I've read this book and I've read that book. I think I'd like to convert to Judaism." I say, "Well, you know more than I did when I first turned up in a synagogue." You know, it's like, I think I'm a Jew. You show up and it's like, hey, welcome. And all of a sudden it's this whole world of learning and culture and tradition. And I really think that process of Baal Teshuvah, which usually kind of capstones, kind of ends at the point of a late bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah. This is where you lead the service and read from the Torah. And this is a tradition we usually do for 13-year-olds, kind of a rite of passage or a coming of age. I wouldn't say into adulthood, but let's just say into maturity as a Jew. From now on, you're not just being brought to shul by your parents. You're going to synagogue because you want to go. You are a Jew who practices Judaism, which is a very interesting point. This process should be more involved. You should have to take some kind of oath, very much like a convert takes an oath. And you should show dedication, just like a convert shows dedication. A person should be a Jew who has shown dedication to practicing Judaism, who professes Judaism, and who has shown dedication to its practice, involvement in the community, and that sort of thing.
Let me challenge that and tell me what you think. And just to clarify, first of all, if there is a person who is a physical descendant, let's say a patrilineal descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and yet they have been brought up in Islam, say, or in Buddhism, or in Christianity, God forbid. So I would say they are still Jewish, but they are apostate Jews. They need to come back to the faith of their fathers. But what you would say, they are not Jewish and they need to convert. Am I fair in saying this? Convert.
I would go so far as to say that the grandchildren of secular Jews should not be regarded as Jews.
Right.
Let alone these people. We get this question, and this is a very interesting point. Let's talk about this.
Okay.
People will raise the question of, say, the Anusim, which is the polite name for this group of people forced converted to Catholicism by Spain, right? Mm-hmm. And then a lot of them ended up in the New World.
Yes.
And some maintain some kind of tradition or what have you. And so now today, generations later, people will go back and dig in their family tree and find out, oh my God, I'm descended from these Anusim. And they say, hey, I'm Jewish. Mm-hmm. Well, not so fast. Your parents were forced converted, but then they raised their children as Catholics, even if they had these other traditions going on. And eventually, after several generations, most of these families lost any kind of touch with this stuff. So most of these people who are Anusim are having to find out through ancestry.com, basically, through genealogical research. They go back and they find, oh my God, we're part of this group. This is an interesting challenge for us. We also now have DNA evidence. DNA evidence brings another interesting question. Can we establish genetically that we're Jewish? And that creates the problem that a person can be a Jew by birth, that is, have a Jewish father, a Jewish mother, or both, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And not have any DNA saying that they're Jewish. I mean, if you go look at my profile picture, you can see I'm blonde. I have a red beard. My ancestors are mostly from Northern Europe. You do a test on me, it's entirely possible that what little Jewish ancestry I have won't appear. Just as much as you might find a person who is descended from several generations of practicing Christians, who then discovers that maybe they have Levitical DNA in their mm-hmm. Y chromosome. Mm-hmm. So this creates some interesting questions. What is really interesting here is that, I want to say, conversion, or the process of Baal Teshuva being made more like a conversion, solves that problem right then and there. Because if you have to say an oath to become an Israelite, we don't necessarily have to be as picky about how you establish the eligibility to be an Israelite. I would be much more relaxed about it if there were this test, this oath that you had to take. And I'll come back to that in a second. Let me give my favorite allegory of American law, because it makes things easy. If I decided that I wanted to leave America, I moved to China, and I decided to celebrate and worship Mao and live as a communist and so on and so forth.
Sure.
And we'll also take, because people who are descendants of Anasim, they'll always object, well, but you're making a choice. Okay, so I'm kidnapped and taken to China and forced to live in China. My children are ideologically brainwashed to be, whichever way you want to do it.
Sure.
Okay. My children are Chinese now. They're you know, they look like Americans ethnically, maybe, but they're Chinese. And then
they're practicing the ways of the pagan nations. They're no longer practicing the faith of their fathers. Right. Yep.
Continue. They're engaged in law enforcement and the military. They're engaging in horrible acts of the suppression of human rights, of murder, and these kinds of things, of tyranny. Okay. And now, after a few generations, they say, hey, you know what? We're Americans. We're going to come back to America. We're going to be members of Congress and judges and presidents, and we're going to be part of the American people. You want to ask at that point, now, wait a minute here, not so fast, right? You guys have been living in China as communists for all this time. What makes you think that we're just going to welcome you back? And I think people should also understand that Jews are, with good reason, insular. We have learned to be very cautious about the people who come to us to convert. History has shown the Jewish people that when there is a lot of interest in Judaism, it is a mixed bag of nuts. It's great to see the fire burning, that people have such a passion. They want to know about Jews. They love Jews, and they're very helpful to us. We have also seen that passion, that burning passion, turn to hate. Martin Luther, for example, was very pro-Jewish. He set out to create a form of Christianity that he felt Jews would be very pleased to convert to. And when Jews refused to do so, he became rather anti-Semitic. So we've learned to be very cautious. When people come to us and say, hey, I want to learn about Judaism, some Jews are just too afraid to say anything. But our institutions are naturally cautious about this. So the point is that it's not rudeness. It's not that we don't want to be welcoming to people. It's not that we don't want to keep people out or say you can't be a Jew or we don't like you or what have you. We just need to be careful who's among us. And I say that either you're raised in the tradition and continue to practice it, or you take some kind of oath acknowledging that you are not a member of another faith, that you, whether you are born eligible or have genetic evidence that you're eligible or you have some kind of ancestry, or you have a certificate of conversion, that you are coming here and you're taking an oath and you're becoming an Israelite and showing your dedication to practice Judaism.
Hezekiah, one of the greatest kings, Hezekiah, that we've ever had, zealous for the faith of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, zealous for the Torah, a great, great king. And yet when his time came and he passed away, his son, Manasseh, reigned in his place. Now, I'm in 2 Chronicles chapter 33, and it says that Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem, but he did evil in the sight of the Lord according to the abominations of the nations, whether in China or wherever, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel, for he rebuilt the high places which Hezekiah, his father, had broken down. He raised up altars for the Baals. He made wooden images. He worshipped all the hosts of heaven and served them. He also built altars in the house of the Lord, which the Lord had said, in Jerusalem, my name will be forever. And he built altars for all the hosts of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Lord. He also caused his sons to pass through the fire in the valley of the son of Hinnom. He practiced soothsaying, witchcraft, sorcery, consulted mediums, spiritualists, and he did much evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. It goes on to say that he even carved an image, the idol which he had made in the house of God, which God had said to David and to Solomon, his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever, and I will not again remove the foot of Israel from the land which I have appointed for your fathers, only if they are careful to do what I have commanded them according to the whole law, the statutes, the ordinances by the hand of Moses. So Manasseh, he seduced Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to do more evil in the nations whom the Lord had destroyed from before the children of Israel. And yet, as you know, Isaac, he was carried away and bound with bronze fetters and carried off to Babylon and by the Assyrians. But when he was there in affliction, he implored the Lord his God and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers and prayed to him. And he received his entreaty and heard his supplication and brought him back to Jerusalem into the kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Lord was God. Now, with that in mind, was there a point that, I mean, did Manasseh begin his life not Jewish? I mean, there are many such examples of Israelites who follow after the nations, the religion of the nations, and they don't remain in the faith of their fathers, and yet they do return and they do repent. But at no point in the Tanakh, when we read such examples, that we do understand that, well, he wasn't Jewish then, but he is now. What's your thoughts there?
This is an interesting problem. Apostasy has always been an issue for Judaism. It's a big problem. What we have here is a child king who, upon coming to the throne, is advised by wicked men, presumably, and he does all of these things. He basically undoes all of the good that his father did. Mm. And this shows you just how far things had fallen. Mm. He was certainly eligible to be an Israelite. His father was an Israelite, among the greatest, for sure.
He was a king, no less.
He was a king, no less.
But what we see is that he is the epitome of evil, really, when we come to, if we need to find the poster boy of an Israelite going astray. Absolutely. And doing absolute extreme wickedness, here he is in 2 Chronicles chapter 33. And yet he doesn't, of course, lose his status as an Israelite. I'm just challenging your view, and I would just say that there's surely examples of Israelites that have gone astray in successive generations, and then at one generation, one of them goes, you know what? No, I'm going to return to the faith of my fathers.
And that return, however, happens through the national authorities. They are accepted upon their return. It's not just that they walked back and said, hey, guys, I'm back. It's not quite that simple.
Okay.
So
let's use an example, perhaps, of because you mentioned Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel is a descendant of Yechoniah.
Yechoniah, right.
Cursed. What's that? Jeremiah chapter 22, I think. Cursed and sent out of the land into captivity. Gone. None of his descendants shall sit upon the throne of David, ruling any more in Jerusalem. Write this man down as childless. A number of generations go by, and all of a sudden, up pops, as you mentioned, not a king, but a governor of sorts. Who helps to reform Israel again as a righteous Jew?
We're not talking about eligibility here. We're just talking about identification. A person is a Jew or an Israelite who practices Judaism. They have to be doing something, right? Now, they may be eligible to be, certainly, and that eligibility can be established. But I just say that, in my opinion, today, now let's also not forget, that at that time, this is Manasseh reigning over a people, right? This is a little bit different today. Now we have this wonderful thing called diaspora. And even though we have Israel back, I want to say, I mean, we've also brought the diaspora back to Israel with us. In a large sense. I mean, the shtetls have basically been moved from Russia and the Ukraine over to Bnei Brak and Beit Shemesh. We now have shtetls in Israel, basically. We have Yiddish. We have all of the wonderful results of the diaspora that came back with us. In any case, secularism and this kind of thing, we clearly have this ethnic identity of Jew. I just object to our using it beyond a certain point or considering an eligibility beyond a certain point for a person just to wake up and say, hey, I'm a Jew, when they have no connection to Judaism. And so what we'll get is we'll get people who, will come up and say in a political situation, you know, well, I'm a Jew and I'm against Israel. Well, of course, you don't go to synagogue. You don't believe anything like us. You're not one of us. And yet you're saying, well, I'm Jewish and I'm against Israel.
And well, there's nothing, okay. I agree, there's nothing more distasteful, I will certainly agree with you there, than a leftist self-hating Jew that wants to bring down Israel. I just, it's beyond me. But I would be of the, so you and I would differ. I would be of the opinion of saying that here we have apostate Jews that need to repent and return to the faith of their fathers. We obviously agree when it comes to the patrilineal rule, which is, as we mentioned, consistent throughout the Tanakh. But then as to who is a Jew, we've got some differing of opinion. So it would be interesting to turn this over
Let me clarify that position. I'm saying that I object to the idea. I'm not saying I wouldn't consider them a Jew. I object to the idea that there are people who call themselves Jews who have no connection to Judaism.
Right.
That's an objection. That doesn't mean I would necessarily count their status. I would really like Judaism as a whole, Karaites, rabbinical Jews of all forms and varieties, to take a deep breath, to step back a little bit, to hug each other, you know, hey, brother. And think for a minute, who is a Jew? What is Judaism? And discuss this. No, we're not all going to agree, but we should definitely get to discussing issues like genetic descent, groups like the Anasim, the Ethiopians, and this kind of thing. And we should take a compassionate approach. We really should try to find ways, exactly, to bring people in. We want to bring people in. Conversion, another big issue. Again, a topic for another time. We want to bring people in. We don't want to exclude. That's the point. We don't want to exclude.
We're talking about a Torah observant in. This is where we have to all agree. That's it.
Practicing. We have to agree to certain boundaries, even if you're going to say, you know, this person's reform or whatever. If you have some kind of connection to Judaism, if you're practicing, if you're involved in Zionism, if you're involved somewhere in Judaism, somewhere in the greater cause of Jews, Judaism, what have you, that you're part of our tribe. But at the same time, if you've gone off and you no longer believe in this stuff, you don't need to use the title. You don't need to use the ethnic identification. Just go be what you are and don't drag the rest of us down.
Don't drag us down. That's fair enough. Isaac Kite of Silver Trumpets, bneimikra.wordpress.com. I'll put a link to his article where you can read further because you do go into some detail in regards to your opinion as to identification. Who is a Jew? I put, as I say, the link under this post. He also manages the Facebook group American Karaite Judaism. Thank you, my friend, for coming back on the program.
Anytime, Jonah.
Always a pleasure. You've been listening to Truth to You with me, Jonah Vandor. Join me on the coming Truth to You Israel tour. Details at our website, truthtoyou.org. That's truth, number two, letter U.org. Thank you for your company, and I hope you'll join us again. Until next time, shalom.